simple and easy to understand and easy to check out. And if you start making it very complex, in those days it would have been very, very hard, first of all, to have any confidence that it worked with reasonable margins, and second, to find out what was the matter with it if it didn't work. And this kind of thing was relatively easy to find out. This is a picture of the early days of the computer, and it was a big computer. It filled a room, which is probably not an awful lot smaller than this one. And here are people starting to put up the racks, later stage. This is a piece of it. See, it was quite high. One of these columns is a digit column, and it would have in it, for instance, in the arithmetic element, it would have the particular flip-flops that went with the particular registers in the arithmetic element. This is the test storage. One of the things we did, we were very worried about the storage tubes, which were the intent to use them. We were developing them ourselves. Storage was always the biggest problem in the early days of computers. So we decided we would put what we call a test storage in, which is 32 registers of switches, toggle switches, plus 5 registers of flip-flops, which could be inserted into any of the places you wanted. And that was a solid, confidence test storage, which you could use for setting things up and testing things. One of the problems we had with it is that there were 32 times 16 plus some extras. There were over 500 switches you had to set up a program, and hardly anybody, I'm not sure anybody ever succeeded in doing it right the first time. One of the reasons being that we had designed it like you see here. This is on one side of the aisle. So if you look at it this way, the biggest digit is to the left and the smallest digit is to the right, but the switches are on the other side, so that the the words were all backwards. That made it hard, but it was by then it was too late to change it when we found that out. This is the control on the left. It was designed for flexibility. It was a 32-way switch, which set up horizontal lines, and then there were vertical lines went to the gates, which could be fed from the various pulses sequences. And you could solder in diodes and change the instructions. I assume that's what Ken meant when he said somebody was doing that in the middle of the night. And if somebody was doing it in the middle of the night, he wasn't supposed to do that. Nobody was supposed to do anything to the machine without putting a red tag on it and filling out the log. But it was easy. There was a temptation. Somebody, he'd run out of space, and he'd say, well, if I just change this instruction a little bit, I'd get a little more room. And there was a lot of temptation to do things like that. This is the control room. That's Jack Gilmore on the left. I think he works for Digital now. And that's Joe Thompson, who, as far as I know, is the world's first computer operator. And the machine brought out all of the switches and lights and things so that you could get at them. The display is on the upper right there. This is a young lady checking out a paper tape. We use paper tape input for anti-tape readers. These are the magnetic tapes. We use magnetic tape drives we bought from Raytheon. We were willing to buy anything we could get from anybody that was a good thing to buy. Unfortunately, there wasn't too much of it. This was mechanically good. Electrically, it wasn't very good because the trouble in those days with magnetic tapes was that there would be flaws in the tape, motes of dust or something. Push the tape away from the head and you get a dropout. These are 6 channels wide, and we discovered by testing it that there was almost never an extra bit. I don't recall ever getting an extra one. And the dropouts were not across the tape. They never exceeded more than about 2 channels wide. So by ganging the channels 3 apart, we were able to get 1 marker channel and 2 data channels, and the thing worked very reliably. As an evidence of what you could do with 32 registers, to test this out, we wrote a program which ran the tape unit, which recorded blocks of, I think it was 128 ones across the tape. And I went back and read them all, and if there was a dropout, it would stop and print out the block number and a picture on the tape of the magnetic tape itself. And that was done with 32 instructions. And it's a wonderful, it shows you what you can do if that's all you got. This is a sketch of the tubes that the Digital Computer Laboratory built. They gun up top rode on a mica screen, and then there was a holding gun, so that the idea was this was a permanent storage, that is, you didn't have to go around and refresh it. And we succeeded in making those, and we succeeded in making them work, but as some of us were talking before the session, it proves what you can do if you got it. Not that it was a really good thing. We finally got two banks of 32 tubes total in operation, and a tube construction facility that was able to make tubes fast enough to replace the ones that were wearing out. And it did work, but it was a very difficult thing to manage. It shows Jay Forrester holding an example of a tube. Pat Utes, the head of the tube shop, and Steve Dodd, the head of the tube facility, storage tube facility, and one of the tubes under construction on the trolley. It shows the tubes in the rack. They were put into a case and trimmed up so they all looked alike, theoretically, and then they were put in pairs in each digit column with the necessary amplifiers and gate generators and so on. One of the things that, as far as I know, we did first was to connect a display to a computer. This was done by taking two of the flip-flop registers in the test storage, putting digital analog converters on them, and driving the XY plates of a CRT, and then the computer would intensify when it needed to. And eventually, when we put many of these on the machine, it was so arranged that all the tubes were deflected at the same time, but the computer would just tell which one was supposed to do it, so you could get different displays on all the different tubes. We did this first because I guess we were the first people to have this kind of problem, and the issue of communications between the individual and the machine on a real-time basis required tubes, it required other kinds of things. For instance, here's a light gun, which was the way we ended up. There are lots of switches and so on, but the computer would display on the display tube, say, tracks or whatever you wanted, and then you could tell the machine to do something by putting the light gun, the photocell, over the spot you're interested in, and when it intensified that spot, it would get a response, and that would tell it was that one you were wanting to work on. We also built joysticks and cursor movers, and nobody ever invented a mouse that I can recall. Now, by about 1951, Rowan was operating with one bank of storage tubes. That's about 1 kilobyte. And we were starting to get involved in a different application. Before we had the simulator, we had done a lot of studies of things for the Navy, and we'd done some work on air traffic control. But the Navy had changed. We were now under the Office of Naval Research, and it was used to giving $50,000 grants to mathematics professors. And Bruin was spending the appalling sum of $1 million a year on developing the machine. And they finally decided that was too much. And so they were going to cut us back to where we just could use the machine but could no longer add to it. And as so often happens, at almost exactly this time, a new application arose, and that is air defense. The Russians had aircraft that could reach the United States on one-way missions. They had set off an atomic bomb. People were really worried about it. It was a high-priority thing. The possibility of using electronic digital computers for handling radar data came up. And the upshot was that the Air Force took over the support of the project and went so far as to create a new laboratory at MIT, which is the Lincoln Laboratory. And most of the digital computer laboratory became part of the Lincoln Laboratory, although it was a residue which stayed at the Institute. And was the first machine on which many people actually had the chance to experiment with electronic digital computer. And it did things like working on computing tapes for the first digitally controlled milling machines and a lot of other applications. For example, it was the machine which Lanning and Zierler used in their first algebraic compilers. Anyway, the laboratory was formed, and in 52 there were really two major decisions. One of them was to build an experimental sector, and this is the experimental sector known as Cape Cod. And those are the locations of the radars which were connected to it. Eventually, there was a big radar at Brunswick and another one down at Montauk, the one at South Truro on the Cape. The others were small radars for gap fillers for looking for low altitude aircraft. All of this was brought together in Whirlwind and used to make a model air defense system. Now that meant adding a lot of things. One of the first things we came up against, we keep coming up against this, and other people do as well, is software. Prior to this, people didn't seem to worry too much about software. You know, the fellow wanted to solve a problem, he sat down and wrote the program. They were fairly short. They couldn't be very long. There wasn't any place to put a very long one. And it turned out that a capable fellow, and they were all engineers. I mean, there were no computer scientists. The software was initially done by engineers, and a good engineer could write a program of, say, 1,000 instructions over a weekend and check it out and make it work. But this problem required like 20,000 instructions, and that turned out to be a different matter. And they were all done in machine language, they were all done in relative address, and it required now setting up standards, finding ways to people to work together, making what would now be called case tools and operating systems and things of that sort. So there's a lot of that going on. Now, one of the things that was needed was a drum memory. There were really two drums. One was the secondary memory, which was capable of holding these 20,000 instructions plus all the data, and which could be put into core or into the central machine. We bought the drum from the ERA in Minnesota. We also used a drum for a buffer. We had to get all this information in. We didn't use interrupt. We didn't have the time to. I mean, if you start asking the machine to stop what it's doing and handle interrupts, it would have been a serious problem. So we used buffers. They're kind of input-output boxes. And the data would come in from the phone line and be stored on the drum with markers, and when the machine got around to it, it would read off all the data that was marked, clear the markers, and leave them open for something else. So those two drums are in the bottom corner here along with the electronics. This is some of the other stuff that we had to build for all of the displays and switches and input lines and everything else that was necessary. This is one of the operational rooms. These show actual Air Force operators sitting at consoles, running the consoles, initiating tracks and directing interceptions and things of that sort. The man who was in charge of this, Bob Weezer, who Ken knows well. I told him that I thought that was a pretty messy-looking thing. It looked to me like it was a warehouse full of displays, and he never forgave me for that, because he said he was very carefully worked out, and I'm sure it was. The thing I think that really saved the whole business is the core memory. And Jay had thought of the core memory sometime before, and at a very low level, one or two people had been working on measuring core characteristics and so on. It seemed obvious that maybe we could make Whirlwind work with vacuum tubes, with storage tubes, but the idea of making Sage work with storage tubes would really boggle the mind. And so we really put a lot of effort into the core memory, and Ken made large contributions to that. We started out with wound ribbon cores, rapidly went to, after a while we got some good ceramic cores, and eventually built a 32 by 32, or 1K word memory out of these cores, hand wound by young ladies. That's a core plane out of Whirlwind. Whoops. Now this is MTC. You recognize it, Kent? When we were working on the storage tubes, we had a test facility in the basement where there was a lot of this digital, pulse digital test equipment, which would generate various patterns and so on for testing the tubes. And I became convinced that, then we subsequently put the tubes in the computer and could use the computer for testing them. I became convinced that the best possible test device was a computer. So when we started to build the memory, I told Jay that we needed a computer to test it. This is my recollection. I may have it wrong, but my recollection is that he was very reluctant. He said, "You guys just want to build a computer." And I denied that. I said we really needed it. So finally he agreed with the proviso that it couldn't multiply. And you didn't need to multiply to test fast storage tubes. So I told Ken that we could build it, but it couldn't multiply. And he said, all right, and he went off and built it. And this is well known as Ken Olson's first computer. He's made hundreds of thousands of them since, but this is the first one. One day, I was trying we got the core memory and got it to working, and everything worked fine, and I mentioned to Jay that this was all a great success, and how about letting us multiply, and he said, sure. And I called up Ken, and I said, it's okay to let it multiply. I think it was 3.5 seconds afterwards that it officially multiplied. Anyway, it turned out to be a very useful thing. We used it for years thereafter. Essentially, all the terminal equipment, input and output gear and so on for SAGE was tested using this computer. It worked so well, the one stack, we made a second stack, so we had 2,000 words or 4 kilobytes of memory. Wonderful. And we put it in Whirlwind. It was all done in a hurry. It had the most profound effect on Whirlwind. It doubled the operating speed, as I recall it. It quadrupled the rate at which you could bring information in from the outside. It changed the mean time to failure of the storage row from something like 2 hours to 2 weeks. And it cut the maintenance time from 4 hours a day to 2 hours a week. And it freed up the whole tube shop to work on display tubes. It was like a miracle for the whole system. This is something about Whirlwind's performance. These are all old slides. The 13,000 tubes included the extras to make a direction center out of it. And it required an hour a day of maintenance, had an MTBF of about 10 hours and about 96.5% available. This doesn't mean that we didn't have problems with it. We used the Cape Cod system not only for experimentation and design purposes, but also for sales purposes. And there was a steady flow of visitors into the laboratory. We used to run an exercise a week and invite visitors. Weezer called it the little theater off Central Square. And, you know, so you get a whole room full of generals, and the machine was supposed to work. Whirlwind had a personality all of its own. It was sometimes fractious. It turned out that George Valley, who was the associate director, for some reason that none of us could figure out, Whirlwind really liked George. If George was around, it would work like a charm. So if it was important to us to get a good demonstration, we'd always get George to come, and then the machine would work fine. He would go out the door, and it would collapse and might stay flat on its back for days afterwards. The second thing that made your decision in 52 was to get on with the problem of getting computers built. This meant the design of a new computer intended for the air defense problem, and also to get some organization to build them. And we went through a source selection in 1952 and picked IBM after looking. The number of people you could that were capable of building computers in the United States was very small, and IBM was seen to be outstanding. So we contracted with them. The first contract was in 52, and the first prototype was delivered in late 54 to MIT. Everybody underestimated the resources required. IBM kept adding people, the Air Force kept adding money, and they ended up eventually building a plant to build these in Kingston, New York. We originally intended to design the machine ourselves and turn it over to somebody to make lots of them. It didn't really work out that way. MIT had limited the size of the laboratory. We couldn't add anybody. There were, I don't know, as I remember it, about 180 or so staff members that in Division 6, a lot of whom were involved in other things. So there were less than 100 engineers available, and it just couldn't hack the job. IBM ended up with hundreds of people. My major recollection of those days is not of making design decisions, but of talking people into turning jobs over to somebody else and so that they could be made available to take on the new things. There was a steady flood of new problems coming in the door, and we somehow had to kick the old problems out in order to get the time. Anyway, that's the way it was. We spent our time looking for people. We spent our time looking for computer time. We spent our time looking for space. We spent our time looking for help, trying to stay ahead, trying to stay on schedule. We missed the schedule by 1 year, which is, I guess, pretty good by today's standards. Made us feel bad, but it was 1 year. It took 6 years from the decision on the part of the Air Force to go ahead and build this thing until we had the first operational center turned over to the Air Force. We had a lot going for us. The big thing we had going for us was that the Air Force gave us its full backing. They were committed. They told us to go ahead and do what we had to do. And if we needed money, they gave us the money. And there were lots of organizations that were available, lots of resources, and a lot of effort. One of the things that amazes me about it now as I look back on it is that the people who were involved were, you know, an old man was 35, and the average age was less than 30. And here were all these billions of dollars being spent and all of these high-powered industrial organizations doing what we told them. And I think there are several reasons for it. I think in the first place, I think the group was competent and did have a good track record. I think we worked very hard to persuade people of what we wanted and not just order them to do it and take their opinions into account. But one of the most important things was that nobody else was willing to take responsibility for it. A lot of people said it couldn't be done, that it didn't make sense, and so nobody would stand up and say, well, I don't agree with you and I will take responsibility for doing it differently. Everybody said, well, okay, you're responsible, we'll do it your way. And also nobody wanted to hold things up because it had such a high priority. So people didn't want to hold it up and they didn't want to take responsibility. The only other alternative is to do what somebody said, and they did what we said. We also had a lot of interesting problems with software. It reared its head again. The SAGE operational program, as I remember, was about 100,000 lines of code, and there were about 500,000 lines of support programs of one sort and another. Compilers and editors and operating systems and test programs and data reduction programs. And this was a truly enormous amount of code for those days. And it was, in fact, the software that caused the slip. The Lincoln Software people made what I believe was a wise but difficult decision, and that is that instead of just starting in to write 100,000 lines of code and hope for the best, they first made a substantial investment in support tools, I guess now would be called case tools, before they wrote the ops code. And that meant that the actual writing of the code was late, but it also meant that the code worked when they got it written, and that's a good trade if you have to make it. The plan was to prepare and maintain one master program, not let people in each center adjust the program. But then the master program had to be adapted to the particular geographic and weapons and so on in each place, in each center. And that took a lot more people than we ever expected. The result was we needed to recruit a software organization, because there were about 50 or 60 people at Lincoln, and that wasn't anywhere near enough. Now, there were no software organizations back in the mid-1950s, and none of the industrial corporations involved, were interested in doing it. We tried to talk IBM into it, and IBM said they built hardware and it was up to their customers to set up their problems. And we said, you're making a mistake, look at the future, you're going to need all these people. And they said, why don't you run your university and we'll run our company. And they had said that to us on other occasions too. That was a mistake on their part, clearly, as they recognized afterward. Sage gave a tremendous boost to IBM, not only in the money, total revenue they got, and the profit they made at it, but I think more importantly in the technology and the support for R&D and the facilities and the very large numbers of trained people they got for doing all kinds of things, computer design, maintenance, system design, field service, all kinds of things. They just got a tremendous boost upward. And they could have had several thousand software people too, but maybe it's just as well they didn't, Ken. Eventually we got a division of the RAND Corporation to do it. They wanted to do it, and RAND spun them off to form the System Development Corporation, which started out as a nonprofit, then turned to a profit maker, and then was sold to Burroughs and is now part of Unisys. And we went out and hired literally thousands of people, school teachers, mathematicians, God knows what, because there were no people who knew anything about software. And they were trained to be Sage programmers and put to work, shipped around the country to these various installations and things of that sort.